Maybe we'll start by defining the MIRA. So MIRA means multi-scale entanglement minimization ansatz. So it's going to be an ansatz for the states, ground states of condensed matter systems. So I will first describe what I mean by these pictures, and then I will explain what the ansatz is. So this is just a quantum circuit. So each box is an operation on some quantum system. And each line is a quantum system. So time here is going upward. And you can think of, at one time, you cut a number of links, wires. And each wire carries a Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space at one time is the tensor product of the Hilbert space associated with each wire. So it's just a quantum circuit. And here we see that we have 1D lattice mapped. So a coarse grained version of the lattice is mapped into a finer grained version.
So this is the opposite of what Giffre defines.
But you can read it in both directions. So the way I like to think about it is one direction is the Schrödinger picture and the other direction is the Heisenberg picture. So I will think of mapping it time going in that direction. The reason is that it's, the whole mapping is trace preserving in that direction. So it conserves probability if you go in that direction.
But that's how we talk about it. It's just that we go in the other way, the arrows go down.
Yeah, so there's a reason why the time I use to go upward is because I will relate it to relativity, where people usually draw diagrams, space-time diagrams with time going upward.
And also, in Giffre's, these triangles are missing here. Does it make any difference?
What is missing?
Triangles.
Oh, yeah, so these squares are actually the triangles. So, it's because I have an automatic tool that generates these pictures and it doesn't have triangles. So. But really.
Oh, yes, there are three wires.
See, that's three wires, so it's really a triangle. So the basic idea is that this map is really. Well, you go from a lower dimension to a higher dimension of Hilbert space, so it's actually an isometry, it's not unitary. Embedding the coarse grained version of that into the finer grained one. And it does it in sort of local way so that. You know, this input can only create correlations on this length scale. Or you can read it the other way, and you can think of these boxes as disentanglers, which attempt to disentangle the inputs, and so they can project it without losing too much information. But really, and there's nothing in GoLab in the boxes, because I'm thinking of the boxes as, well, they are placeholders. I would think of the parameters of the ansatz will be the parameters of the isometries and unitaries I put inside the boxes. So here, this is one measure that you can find something similar on any kind of lattice. And it really goes from fine graining to coarser graining. So I can, of course, repeat this step. So this is the same step, but applied to the coarser grain, coarse grain even more. Right? So we imagine that after a certain number of steps, we stop, and it will input some fixed states on what's on the last step. So the input will be some fixed state, some fiducial state. And then this computation will output a state on my initial lattice. And of course, the state that is output depends on the parameter of the unitaries and isometries in each boxes. So these parameters are the parameters that parameterize the ansatz, the state that this defines on the output lattice. So this defines what the ansatz is. So why would we do so?
Sorry.
Yeah.
In the picture that the usual picture of MIRA, there is a fan, and then these circuits are coming in the sides.
Yeah. So you will get this. You know, quite often they cut it into a triangle like this, because if you find that is, you don't really need the rest. But it's just a different way of basically drawing it. If that is infinite, then here I'm mostly right. Well, I'm pretty sure I imagine that this is infinite, and then there's no boundary, right? Okay, so the nice thing about this construction is that, well, the basic idea is that it's a more introduced correlation at every length scale, so it should be able to describe correlations of a very large length scales. And also, it has a self similarity appearance, so it's actually good at describing self similar. Critical. And what's also nice about it is that it's very easy to compute efficiently a expectation value of local observables. So why is that? So if you want to compute an observable which acts only on a certain number of lattice sites here, then it means you can forget about the other outputs. So this little bar means tracing out, means we forget about it. Now if you think it works as doing some calculation computation, if I don't care about the output of all the output of one of the box, it means I don't have to care about, I don't even have to compute it. So on all the boxes, I can propagate backward the tracing out. I don't need to do the computation if I will throw away the output of the computation. So if I did one step, then I get this. So I can just forget about the output of that box because I'm not going to use it later. If I only compute an expression value here. And you can propagate this backward. So this would be like the causal path of this regime. These are the systems that on which this region depends, and no other system. So let me say more about the property that you can propagate these traces backward because of the way that the circuit is built. So I'll just give an example where this box could be a unitary geometry or a channel. And imagine that this channel is implemented as through this circuit. So again, this is what I did before. It's clear that if I trace one of them, then I don't need to do this calculation here. So I can propagate the trace backward. This is just a trace preserving property of the box. So I could view this equation as a constraint on what this box can be. I say that there exists such an M so that I can write it in this way. And that means that no information is flowing from this wire to this wire. This is a causality constraint. Instead, there can be no communication, no influence from here to here.
So just to clarify, are you intending this as there exists M for all N or there exists M for some N?
This is a constraint on a given N.
Okay. A specific N, the one you were looking at last time, on the last slide.
I'm trying to define the thing in general. So that I will call this kind of equation a causality constraint. So if N is such that there exists M, then I say that there's a causality constraint on N.
Yeah.
So I can write an equation. So this is just the same thing as this diagram, but an equation. So the star means that I'm looking in the Heisenberg picture. So I'm mapping observables backward in time. So this means that here, if I measure an observable on the left side, and then map it backward in the other picture into an observable that acts on both systems, then really it acts only on the first system, meaning that an observable that I measure here doesn't learn anything about an observable of the system on the right. I can also rewrite it in this way, because if there's a fixed input, then which channel I use doesn't really matter. And of course, this is a statement about the structure of this observable. It says it could be any a prime, so they're only saying that it has to act trivially on the right hand side, on the right system, which is the same as saying that it's.
Sorry, I'm still not completely clear what you're doing here. You started off by looking at this example with N1 and N2, where N1 was applied first and N2 was applied second. Now we've generalized to an N where it's not clear to me whether we still have that structure or whether we could, in this example, have the reverse structure where N2 is applied first and then N1 is applied second. And then it would appear to me that you can't carry out this sort of restriction to a single site. So I'm just not clear whether you're saying we can do that or...
Yeah, so right now I'm just abstracting this structure. I look at some property of this box structure that I found useful, and I'm trying to abstract it to its bare essence. And then I will try to see if I can really go back the other way, and from this only condition, rederive the box structure.
Okay, I'll see where you're going with this, and then I'll see if I need to ask you anything more.
Okay, maybe this is going to be more clear.
So is there any particular meaning we have to attach to these boxes? I mean, on the one hand, you seem to be saying that's abstract.
They are.
But then you're writing equations.
Yeah, so the way I wrote the equation is thinking of it as a quantum channel, which is just a marginal thing I can do in the system.
Okay, so, yeah. I'm not sure that everybody here knows what you mean by a quantum channel.
Well, if you don't, then it doesn't really matter because it's just think of, then you can think of it as a unitary map, is that what you're familiar with. It just can be generalized. You can, oh, it doesn't even have to be quantum mechanics. This equation will work even if it's a classical system. Then you just interpret the boxes as doing something physical to your system. And this means that you only have to act on the first system. So it's a very, very basic.
And the bar meant?
I'm not going to do anything further with this system. I can just straight away ignore it. But in quantum theory, it's just a trace.
So this equation says that if you are going to ignore one of the systems.
So it's saying that if I ignore this system at the output, I can even ignore the input, this input.
But surely if you had, if N had a substructure consisting of a unitary mixing of your two input channels, and then discarding one of those outputs, you couldn't actually reduce like this. You'd have to reduce to a triangular box. Two inputs, one output.
Absolutely. So, in general, of course, you could draw a box here with the two inputs and the output that would not be a constraint at all. That would just be the general thing that's happening.
Yes. So what we're saying is that N is not. So this is describing a particular class of boxes which are denoting N.
Yes. No. I mean, well.
This is
an equation. This is a non-trivial equation that some N could have to satisfy.
Some N will satisfy, but not all N.
Not all N.
Okay, good. That's just what I was not clear about, because from the diagram,
I'm just trying to explain the physical meaning of this equation then, for a given N.
So if you have an N that fulfills this, that means that there is no communication.
So this is really this equation for a given N. If a given N satisfies this equation, it really means that there can be no communication from here to here, and that's all it means. But you can rewrite it this way, so that's maybe more familiar if you do quantum field theory. So it just means that if you evolve an observable in the Hadamard picture that is local in the first system, it commutes with any observable that's local to the right system, the second system. So that's really for all P, right? And this kind of communication condition is exactly the same thing that people use having in quantum field theory. Suppose these are bosons, bosonic fields, then if you have, so I just evolve this field in the Heisenberg picture, that's how I define the time parameter of the field operators. Then if I evaluate them as two space-time points which are not causally connected, then they will commute. This is the usual assumption when we contest the quantum field theory on a metric. And it's the same time of relation. So here there's a discrete version of this. So suppose you have only four space-time points. No time speeds going upward. Let's call this Alice in the past and Alice in the future and Bob in the past and Bob in the future. Then I will specify this type of constraint on the evolution, on the common evolution of Alice and Bob in terms of a graph, a bipartite graph. So this graph here means there's no line connecting Alice to Bob to Alice. That means that Bob cannot communicate to Alice. And this, therefore, corresponds to a constraint on the evolution. So suppose the evolution is unitary, represented by U. This picture will represent this equation, which says that Bob cannot talk to Alice, even though Alice is allowed to send information to Bob. And that's what the equation gives you. So now I can decide to define the mirror in a different way, so that I will still get this property that I can propagate backward the computation without only having to care about the past light cone. So the way you want to read this is as a space-time diagram, where each point is an event in space-time, and these lines define a causality relation. So it is a causal set. But I want to interpret it as, so again, at each time, space is defined by this particular point, which each carry a Hilbert space. So this dot now, so remember, if we go back, this applies to unitary, which has two input and two outputs, right? So the Hilbert space of the inputs correspond to these dots and also for the outputs. So now the Hilbert spaces here are no more lines, they are no more wires, they are dots, right? And these lines are the causality constraint that applies to, that I want to apply to the steps of evolution between two steps in time. So in that case, you see that at each step, I'm just coarse graining the lattice, the 1D lattice, by removing half of the points, just like with the mirror before. And in this case, I'm allowing each point of the coarse grain lattice to communicate to only the three nearest neighbor in the next step. Or I could allow it to communicate to the four nearest neighbor. Many possibilities, many things are possible. So then, let's see what. So what I want is that this puts constraint on. Okay, so implicitly, when I draw this picture like this, I imagine that it's defining constraint on a system of discrete time evolution. So now this is again wires and boxes like in the first picture. So this is a circuit where each box is a channel or an isometry. And each line is a Hilbert space, time going still upward. And you see that here I have a mapping 1-to-1 between these wires, intermediate wires, and the dots of the previous image. So now if I look at one of the boxes that maps one step to the next step, like this one, then all of the lines which do not exist in these diagrams correspond to an equation, a causality constraint on the possible isometries I can put in that box. And because of the way I define this, because of the causality constraints are defined, it means that if I want to evaluate an observable which is local to this point, so I trace out all the other ones, then I can again propagate backward without even having to know that there's a box, whether even there is a box structure that I can use to represent these big boxes. It just comes from the causality constraint that I am allowed to do this. Also, I didn't say why this is useful, because you see that when I go backward like this, the number of line actually will tend to 3 in this case. This means that after a while, I will only have to multiply tensors which have a fixed dimension. And also, typically the number of steps will be logarithmic in the size of the lattice, so the computational time is good. So, now the second question is, can I parameterize the set of all isometries on one step which satisfy my causality constraint? Here I see that they have a property that allow me to compute things efficiently with it, but I don't know if I can even parameterize it.
Okay, just to make sure I understand. So Pan, you said, now I'm going to have this cochonning transformation, these isometries, which are the big boxes, and you are going to enforce, you're going to suppose that they have this causal structure. But it's an abstract property that allows you to compute things efficiently, but you still don't know what this abstract property implies in practice.
Yeah, in practice, I do not know how to characterize a set of all elements which do respect this.
So these isometries at the moment are, they have many inputs, many outputs,
and
as such, they could be exponentially large.
Yeah, a priori, the number of parameters could be exponential, I don't know.
But you import this constraint. Now you want to see.
So I don't know yet if I can encode them efficiently. But I can know that if I could encode them, then I can compute things efficiently, at least. So that's the first step. And now it turns out that there's a very nice theorem that shows that these causality constraints are almost sufficient to show that you can actually parameterize these things efficiently in terms of local operation, just as we had before. So let me explain this theorem now. So I take the simplest example, so I already said that, right, so I define my causality constraint. So I just take the example where we have two input, two output, where the only constraint is that the guy on the right cannot talk to the guy on the left, or cannot send information to the guy on the left. So it should correspond to one equation, which is this one. So I just write this equation now as a circuit, so no time goes from left to right, so for that it just fits better in the page. But it's a circuit just like before. So it's just a circuit corresponding to expressing this same equation. There's no problem with this language. So, of course, tensor products correspond to parallel lines vertically. Right, and and things are applied in that direction instead of the other direction, because when you read an equation, we want to apply a state here, whereas here the state is applied here. I hope that's okay. So the first step for the theorem is to realize that if that's true for all, if for all A there exists A prime, this A can also act on the large. So it's easy to show that, it's easy to see that it's still true if there's a larger system. Okay? Now the trick is to, so this is true for all A, right? So one of these A I can choose is the swap operation. And an A prime can be, so there exists A prime, but A prime can be easily determined from this equation. It's easy to see what A prime is. So what this shows is that, so this is the basic property we're going to use to decompose U into local boxes. What you see here is that, so we are talking about property of U, which is the same U as here, right? So the property was that, this guy cannot get information from this guy. So the, it means that the causal past of this wire is only this wire instead of both wires. So you see that this operator here is acting only on this wire and not this one. It's only acting on the causal past, and it's interacting the causal past of this output with basically a copy of the output, right? Because here it's swapping two systems which have to be the same. So what we introduced here was really a copy of this output. And this box is interacting a copy of the output with the causal past of that output. Okay, I'll restate this later. So to show how we can use this to decompose one unitary into local boxes, I'm going to use this. I'm going to do it for this very simple example. So here I have a unitary which has three input and two outputs, and I want it to satisfy this causality constraint. So what are these? Here there are two equations, right? Because there are only two links which are missing. This guy cannot communicate with this guy, and this guy cannot send information to this guy. So the first step is this. So I'm going to have an equation of the form U equal, and then I will show that it's equal to something that is a local implementation of U. So the first thing I can do is just add the number 1, multiplied by the number 1, which is, if I take some fiducial pure states, input them into U dagger, and then trace out the results, I have done nothing. So I can do this in parallel. It doesn't change what I'm actually doing here. In both cases, I have only three inputs and two outputs, and the operation being done on the input and the output is the same as before. It's just that I've done something silly next to it. So I'm just moving the box here. I've done nothing again. The same box we had before in red, but I moved it here and I swapped the two inputs. So now we have, now I can translate the two swaps and introduce U dagger U in the middle, because that's just the identity, since U is unitary. So when I do this, you see that I actually need this to be unitary. It cannot be an isometry or a channel for now, because this would be a projector otherwise, if it was an isometry, for instance. Now, that's nice, because you see here the Heisenberg map. This is the Heisenberg evolution applied to the swap of the first output, on the second output. And this is Heisenberg map of the swap on the first output of U, which I know can be implemented locally. So I know that because this output, which is this output, doesn't, its causal past is only these two guys, not including this one, I know that this whole thing will act only on these three wires and not the first one. So it will be some operator acting, leaving this one alone. It acts only, it will only interact this wire, which corresponds to one of the outputs, with its causal past, which are these two wires. And the same string is true for the other one. So now what I have is a local implementation of the unitary. And it's important to notice that the way I did it, I could have done it the other way around. So I could have used my swap in the other order, and I would have had the same box A and B here. In fact, it's easy to see in general that they commute because they are just swaps on different systems represented in different bases given by you. So the theorem says that, so in general it works in this way, right? If you are given a unitary which has to respect a causality constraint given by a bipartite graph like this, what you do is you start with all the inputs. Here there are three inputs, and you add copies of the output with a fixed input state which doesn't matter. So here are two copies of the outputs, but no views at fixed inputs. It's just a copy of the hyperspace, right? And the theorem says that then that it I can implement U by interacting one output with its causal past and the other output also with its causal past, and then trace out my inputs. So I'm just left with the outputs.
The
fact that these two boxes commute is very important. It's an extra constraint, right? So from this, if you look at it in this way, then you see that it's clear that this wire cannot communicate with this wire. But then you're right, this wire could communicate with this wire. But in fact, it can't because the box commutes. Indeed, if you commute them, you get this, and you see that here that this wire cannot, in fact, communicate with this wire. So the theorem says that you have this, you can implement TU by local operations which commutes. So then the game just parameterizes this commuting local operations. And this can be done for any bipartite graph. And it should be clear how it generalizes. So is there any question on this
one? Sorry, what's the statement about A and B? Do they commute or they commute in this function?
No, they actually commute.
They actually
for over all their the commuting they are acting only sharing this. Only if they are sharing this wire.
And
no, even without the traces.
Is that
obvious? It's you can see it if you see what they are
making. Actually, they don't have all the time. The computation would not be all the time. So, yeah. Okay.
You see, because what they are. They are just two swaps, but represented in a different place. And the swaps are on different wires, so they're visually coming.
Yeah, they appear in the context where there's a trace, yeah.
Yes, but this is they don't need that to commit. They commit as boxes. Without, even if there's no trace, they still commit. Yeah, it's important. With that defines the property. Even if you didn't trace the common wire, you still commit.
Even if you don't
trace
one?
Yeah. They commit when they act on the same, when they only share this wire. I couldn't act it on the same wire.
So you can literally expand, remove the traces.
Yeah.
If
I remove the traces, this thing starts to leak.
Okay.
And even if I change this.
Yes. What about the general case where you have n output wires? So then you have n boxes.
Yeah, so what you see is that.
But my question was would they all commute to each other? Like
yeah, so
AM,
so, so all the boxes that you will get in this way will come in with each other, all of them.
Oh.
Yeah.
I guess you need some sort of appropriate generalization of the constraint as well. It's not obvious to me what that would be.
Sorry, what do I need?
It's not obvious to me how you generalize the constraint on you in that situation.
In what situation?
If you have multiple wires, like we can just sort of.
Oh, you mean how this term will work with multiple wires?
Can you give us some more complicated example?
Yeah, so. So suppose you have number of inputs, outputs and inputs, and some connection. This more complicated. They don't have to be one easy input. There could be any topology. It can be really any property graph. So again, time goes like this. So these are the outputs. So the way I implement this is the following. I'm given these guys, they are the inputs to my system. then I'm creating copies of the seabed spaces with some fixed input, some fixed state that doesn't matter. And then I have to have this guy interact with his causal past, which is this student. So there'll be one of these operators acting only on this.
Well, three, surely.
One more.
Oh, sorry. So this guy really had to react also with only this pass, so I guess I'm not making a mistake here, it's only these two guys. This guy interacts with these two guys. This guy with these three guys, and this guy with these two guys. So here I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 commuting operators implementing my math. And then I trace over the inputs and I'm left with the outputs, which is what I want.
And the order which you apply all these 5 paths.
So the order doesn't matter because they all commute.
Okay.
Of course, the commutation constraint only apply, is only non-trivial for when these boxes act on some common state system. Okay. So now this term works only for unitary math. Why is that? So here's an example. So what I mean by here, I mean that I create a state that might be entangled in two systems and then I make it interact with two other systems, with the two inputs, and I get the two outputs. Now, in this case, it's easy to see that there is no communication either way. The system on the left cannot communicate with the right, and the right cannot communicate with the left. And it's an isometry. It has to be an isometry because I introduce this state which will increase the dimension. So, if this was a unitary with the same causality constraint, it could not introduce any correlation. However, if it's an isometry, it can create, it can introduce any correlation. And if I wanted so it means that if the only constraint where the causality constraint that apply on the isometry is given the step of the mirror, then these steps will be allowed by this causality constraint to introduce a state entangled over any length scale, any distances. And I will again need an infinite number of parameters, an exponential number of parameters to encode these steps. So that's not what I want. So what I want is just that if my steps are isometric, I only allow it to introduce states locally, not entangled. So I will just say that even more generally, if I have a channel, say with 3 inputs and 2 outputs, first I want to represent it as a unitary map with some local inputs and local outputs. Such that, and then I will say that this channel is purely causal with respect to a given causality constraint on its input and output if these guys grouped have the same, if U has the same causality constraint for on these other input and outputs, where which are grouped with their local parts, right?
Sorry, that is a way of the timing work?
I would say that N, well, okay. Before I would say, let's go to language, let's say that U is causal with respect to a given causality constraint if it satisfies all the corresponding equations. And I would say that N is purely causal with respect to the same some causality constraint if it can be written as a unitary map which satisfies the same constraint, but which has local extra inputs.
So to each input and to each output in N, you want to add locally?
So it's an isometry, it's allowed to add something. But in general, you could add something entangled. So I'm asking it so that you can only add stuff locally.
But locally means
locally means
associated to means some input.
In terms of the causality constraint, they are associated with the corresponding inputs, right? So it's kind of a cheap way to generalize the theorem, because then, of course, I can apply this theorem to you, and I get the right parameterization. So it's sort of a cheap but natural way of extending the theorem to isometries in general. It could be that there are more general causality constraints, which would be sufficient, but I'm not aware of it. Okay. So this theorem is very general, but let me give you another theorem, if you wish, which works only in special cases, and which tell you that the mirrors in 1D that people are using actually really are the same thing as some that you can define with a causality constraint. So it turns out that it turns out that for this particular causality constraint between two 1D lattices, where one connects to four systems, then the set of isometries which are purely causal with respect to this causality constraint is the same thing as a set of isometries that are implemented in one step of the binary mirror.
And they all cool?
No, this is a different representation theorem, but which works only for this very simple connectivity. So this is a different way of representing a causal system by a box, which you can prove differently using the same idea. Okay. You could also, of course, apply the general theorem, the general representation theorem, and have an expressive minimum of commuting boxes. It would not obviously look like the mirror. So just to show that this step is the same thing as this.
Sorry,
I didn't
understand the last sentence. So you have the theorem that shows that that you can decompose
any causal system
into the commuting parts, and that has nothing to do with that because this box is non-commuting.
Yes.
But do you have some for this pattern of, how do you call this, causality? Left hand side is what? Causality pattern?
The structure.
Structure?
Yeah.
Would you be able to
relate
that to a set of
commuting
boxes?
Yeah, using the term, it will give me a set of commuting boxes which respect the same quality constraint, which is the most general thing you can do as well.
And how would that look like?
Well, they're the same trick. So you want to see it now or can do it later?
I'll ask you.
Yeah. But there's also that some of the variety we have used is actually as general. And the 10 areas where you have 1-3 core screening also works. So the only difference is that I guess in the dimension of the unitary wires there's no constraint on them. However, these boxes have to be unitary and these have to be isometric. So of course the product can be larger than d squared with these dimensions. Okay. So now let me go to the continuous stuff. So the basic idea to compare this to a metric, so we're going to use this evolution of a lattice, so it looks like a discrete version of space-time where fields are evolving in time. Right? Now, to make a precise connection with the metric, one should know that you can always, if you have a metric, a Lorentzian metric on a space-time, then it defines a causality relation between the event. It says which event are in the future of which other event. And that's a partial order. Cause the causality structure of the space-time. So it turns out that if you don't know the metric, but you only know the causality structure of the space-time, then up to the conformal factor, you can determine what the metric is. So all you need to determine the metric is the causal structure and a volume form or a conformal factor. So here, in the case of this discrete mirror.
Sorry, first thing. What do you mean by, if you know the causality structure in the case of a continuous space-time? Is it that two points are either coupled connected or not?
Yeah, so all you know is whether or not they are one point can be influenced by another or not. That's on or off. You only know the causal cone structure. You only know where the cones are.
Okay, so it's a discrete thing. It's yes or no answer.
Yes, it's yes or no. It's just a special order.
Either
they are related or they're not related. Oh, no. So here, in this kind of picture, the mirror is defined by also a causal set, but of a discrete number of forms. So we have a causal structure. And I will explain how the conformal factor comes in. So first of all, what I want to do is to embed. So this was how I would define one. The binary mirror in terms of the causal structure. What I want is to embed my discrete event. So I will interpret this intermediate event space of the mirror as events in a space-time. And I want to embed it into a flat Minkowski space-time such that the causal order my mirror is induced by the causal order of the embedding Minkowski space. So you see that the way I'm writing, so now we can think of, you know, this is R2, and I've coordinated each of the event P2 R2, and I did it such a way that the lines cannot go at at an angle greater than 45 degrees. So it's easy to convince yourself that if these points were embedded into Minkowski space, then this will define the this will be the Gaussian order that they inherit from the ambient Minkowski space. And so what I want is that the metric, so in the coordinates that I used in this coordinate system, where I want the metric to have to be conformally equivalent to flat Minkowski space. So if I write any metric in this form where this can be any function, I know that the Gaussian structure is that one, so that has to be true. So all I have to, all I have left is to determine what this conformal factor F is. So the way I will determine it is I will say, suppose now I will change coordinates and make my points to be all equally spaced in space and time. So I didn't change the way they were connected. I just compactified, I just change the way they are embedded into R2. Right? So in this new coordinate set, so it's clear because the way the memory is defined, it's clear how to what change of coordinate will go from the previous picture to this picture. And in this new coordinate system, I want the volume form to be constant. Because what I want is that if I take a region of space-time, I want the volume of the Minkowski of the metric to correspond to the number of events contained on space. Now if I do this thing, that I have enough information to find the full metric and determine what this function. And it's easy to see that you can see that it has to be this this factor. So what you get is the system metric. So this was the system coordinates in it that I show first, where you have a constant speed of light, and this is the other coordinate system where the metric is constant. As a constant volume form. So let me just go back one step. So if you are familiar with the Sitter space, you can recognize the horizon here. So suppose that you are one guy here, then you see from this line that this guy can never learn about anything that happened outside of this tube of width three. So this is a causal horizon, this is a cosmological horizon. In the Sitter space, but in this discrete representation. Of course, if you are here, I could just change coordinate system so that you look like you are here with a different coordinate system, and then you would again see that you have this Gaussian horizon size 3. Three lattices.
I'm sorry, I'm not sufficiently familiar with this. So, what are you calling horizon?
Yeah, so in this space, there's what they call a horizon. So, the idea is that it's like if you are on Earth, on a sphere, you cannot see past the horizon. And here as well, you cannot see past this distance because there's no causal line that allows you to learn about
it. So who is not capable of seeing beyond?
Okay, so anyone, so let's take this guy.
But the time was going up, right?
Yeah, time is going up. So horizontally is space.
Okay.
So the horizon is this span, this region around this guy. So everybody has his own horizon, but if you are on a sphere, the horizon is local.
So you given a point in space time.
Given a point in, or given a guy, say that's yeah, sorry. So
I don't know what the guy means in this context.
Yeah, you're right. So suppose there's a guy that's, so you need a lifetime. So the guy that stays here.
Okay. So that defines space time for the.
Yeah, constant. But I mean, he could not have come from anywhere outside of this either. But okay, let's just there's one guy staying here. Right? You can see from the way the causal lines are built that he can never, at any point, get information from outside of his horizon. Just like on the Earth, you can see past your horizon.
So is it true that a guy from left?
So. Well, I mean, this coordinate is, you see that it's not translation invariant for you. It's always easier to, it's hard to look at what happened to this guy to put the length of it. The best is just to, if you want to talk about this guy, to change the coordinate system, see where he is. Now, it's clear that, you know, this guy can talk to, can send information outside of his arrays, but he won't receive any information from the past. So let me just give you an example in the continuum of what happened in Nemera when you compute the correlation function between two local observables. So now this is just a space which is going upward, and in the same set of coordinates that I showed before where you can see the horizon. So now this is the boundary of the horizon for this guy. And so suppose I want to, so in this coordinate system, the density of discrete point of the mirror is proportional to the distance, to the R2 distance. So this this shaded region is the causal path of the union of this space region and this space. So if you compute, so it means that someone here cannot receive information from, or an event, in an event here, you cannot receive information from anywhere in the shaded, you can only receive information from anywhere in the shaded region in the past. And so if you numerically compute the cohesion function between an observable which is local to here and one local to here, then you only have to include, to care about the component, the parameters of the boxes of defining the regions which are inside this region. And you see that as you go further and going down, this always tends to basically this horizon size, which corresponds in the case of the binary mirror to to a dimension of 3 wide. And let me just say one word about one thing that this could be used to. So you could think of people have been trying to define a continuous mirror, so a mirror for quantum field theory. So this picture suggests that that natural correspond, the natural thing that corresponds to the discrete mirror case is, if you wish, all possible dynamics with a given causality, or all possible dynamics on the sitter space. Of course, that's not an easy thing to do in the continuum. But. So let me give you just an example to show that if you define a mirror, this a continuous mirror this way, then you actually seem to recover what the group has defined. I will just give the bottom of the slide. So let me just take an example. So suppose I have a scalar field in the sitter space with some sources. So for instance, this J could contain the parameters of your variational parameters, or they could be in the mass. Then this, people know how to quantize this in the space. It's a free field. And you can then look at what the Hamiltonian is in this coordinate system where the volume form is constant. And what you get is that the Hamiltonian has two terms. It has one term which is the same field but in flat space-time. So it's a local Hamiltonian. And then another term which generates the expansion of space, or which generates the scaling transformation, or the renormalization. And this is the same term that that these people have come at from a different point of view. So it also matches one proposal of continuous mirror.
But do you have anything to say about efficiency in any scheme based on these ideas? So in the end, if you want to use this as a variational answer, you should be able to compute expectation values of local observables. Is there anything you can say about
it? Okay, so no. All I can say is that if you discretize it in any way, you will very likely get the same, again, all the same property of efficiency that you had before. Because
if you discretize
it, whenever you discretize it, you will keep this basic causality property, which is what you need for it to be efficient.
But you don't have a continuous version of that.
No.
This Lagrangian that you have is in background, which is a de Sitter space.
So well, it's for in any background that you can you can take G to be de Sitter.
But people defining continuum as well, like field theory in flat space. And they looked at the ground state wave function and
all that. Yeah,
so what is the connection?
Okay, so there's no connection. The only connection between, so there's nothing physical. This is just, if you
It's not that you are solving that field theory.
No,
and looking at the derivatives.
But you could, but you have some other Hamiltonian which has nothing to do with it, which is your physical Hamiltonian of which you want to find the ground state,
right,
which has nothing to do with it. The only thing in common it has to do with this is that it's viable in the same field.
So the physical Hamiltonian is just in the Mikoski space-time.
Is that described on the output boundary, which is flat in that, which is not related to Minkowski, which is just which
so for simplicity.
It could be Minkowski.
Like,
it could be non-relativistic.
In a transfer speed, no.
It could be non-relativistic.
Okay, non-relativistic. Then what is this Lagrange now?
So imagine that this physical Hamiltonian you have that you want to understand has some variable, which is a scalar field, phi. So this is a Lagrangian in the same field, but which whose structure has nothing to have to do with the other one. The only so this one is defines this continuum evolution in this abstract discrete time. So the only common thing is this. So this is discrete space with an open boundary, which is flat. Or well, you could say that. So your physical field is defined, if you wish, on the field at this boundary. And no, this time here is no physical time, just the tool, the reverse. If you want this parameter here is the renormalization, is the scale of your renormalization.
So the boundary contains both space and time of the problem that I'm interested in.
Yeah, so you can imagine that your physical time is going perpendicular, if you wish.
So the SCFT, but without the A. It's the SCFT.
Because I'm trying to see the, I mentioned the Mera wave function, where that's the bottom level.
Yes,
there is no time. It's a ground state wave function.
There's no time in that picture, no physical time. There's only this kind of virtual time, which is the scale that, that the computation time of my mirror outputting must be at the final time here. So this is just like the picture I had before. It's just a continuum version of the picture I had before, where I had these boxes going upward and outputting my final state that I'm interested in, right? Except that it's just continuous now. Okay, so that's all.
Okay. I think that's the first figure that finishes on time. So,
any questions?
Okay, I still, you know, if you go back, action thing, yeah. Now, what is the message? The message is that if you solve another problem in which is living in visitor space-time, then evolving in time, you will find solution for your problem, which is in flat space-time.
For instance. So how will I do this? So suppose that this may not be enough parameters to match your actual physical system, but suppose it is. So suppose that, you know, this source field is free. It can vary in space and time.
Mm-hmm.
There are just three parameters. Imagine that. Then I give you give me your the Hamiltonian of your physical system you are trying to understand. And what I will do is I will take your Hamiltonian and take it as an operator acting on this field phi. And I will use this Hamiltonian to this other Hamiltonian to evolve it in the Hertzberg picture until I feel like stopping. Then I will project it onto fixed state. And then I will get a number. I will get the expression value of your Hamiltonian in the state that's been defined as the output of this transitor evolution. And now I want to change this parameter until I minimize this number I get. When I'm done, I get something hopefully that's close to your ground state energy of your Hamiltonian. And the output state of now this Lassiter space with the given J that optimizes this problem will give you an approximation to your ground state of your Hamiltonian.
Okay, but just to be clear on that, if I give you M and J, but depending on space and time,
yep,
maybe they are constant, where are they? Would you be able at this point, compute anything on the the boundary?
In this case, maybe, because that's a very simple example. I don't know if...
But I would say, well, but this would generate Gaussian states on the
yeah.
Yes.
So you might want to think...
Sorry?
You might want to think more complex. But I really have no intuition anymore.
You know, we had the workshop here.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the big questions is, can we go beyond the theory in this?
Of course. So the difference is maybe between this and this work, so at least L is compatible, but this picture I give gives give a lot more constraint on what this K can. Because now I know that this K has to be the exact causative constraint of Lorentz space-time. And that's quite a strong constraint. And people also know a lot about how to build quantum filter which respect this constraint.
So this change from ADS to DS, what does it mean?
So
that means it's a new connection.
Yeah, the argument is entirely different. So it's a different connection.
Because there also they start with the RG scale.
Yeah, so they're not very different. The only difference, I mean, if you recrotate the sitter, you get ADS. Well, not really you. I mean, in the ADS case, you don't have time. Right? You only compress the mirror to a space-like slice of ADS, which is a hyperbolic space. Now, if you retrotate the sitter, you also get hyperbolic space. They're not that far, right? But the argument is different. So the argument for ADS is in terms of computing an entanglement entropy, whereas here the argument is in terms of the causality. So they seem to be entirely different arguments.
Questions.